Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is The Compliance Guide.
The Compliance Guide.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is The Compliance Guide. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
Everybody, welcome to this episode of The Compliance Guy. It is Tuesday, the 5th of December, last month of the year, and it is going to be an interesting discussion because it is a hashtag Terry Tuesday, and dare I say, one of our last episodes for 2023. So with that said, I will welcome my very good friend, Terry Fletcher. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. Good morning, everybody.
All right. So today, you know, we're only going to take on one specific topic, and it's a very specific HCPCS Level 2 code. And this code, I've tried to ignore it. Because for me, when I try to ignore a code, it usually means that it is a high-risk code. And it's something that could potentially create more headaches than it's worth. You know, there's an old saying, sometimes the squeeze just ain't worth the juice. Well, this just may be the case on this one. But I'm taking it from a pessimistic perspective, so I will turn it over to my good friend Terry, and maybe she will take it from a benevolent standpoint.
Well, I think the one thing that we want to bring to the attention of the viewers is the fact that you've asked us to kind of break down this code, and it's G2211. It's the new 2024 add-on code. For patients that you're treating with, they call it the longitudinal care. That seems to be the buzzword about that. And what it is, it says visit complexity inherent to evaluation and management associated with medical care services that serve as the continuing focal point for all needed healthcare services and or with medical care services that are part of ongoing care related to a patient's single, serious, or complex condition, add-on code to an office or other outpatient and management service. I was laughing as I was reading it because it says a whole lot of nothing. It's not giving us a clear understanding of what this code is.
Instead of a paragraph of description, why not just say, code G2211 is an add-on to take into consideration additional costs with providing complex, you know, longitudinal primary care, whatever that means, and encompasses additional time, intensity, and practice expense, i.e. the cost of doing business. Why not just say that?
Why not say that? Exactly. I mean, they had CMS had a webinar. And the gist of the webinar, and also from the final rule that was released November 2nd, I got the information that says it believes this will be used, and this is a real problem. You'll hear what I mean when I say it. It says it'll be used by primary care and other specialties who treat single serious condition or complex conditions with a consistency and continuity over a long period of time.
CMS. But it's a primary care code. It's a longitudinal primary care code. I mean,
but did you hear what I said in there? It said, and other specialties. It didn't say which ones, Sean.
I heard blah, 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 blah.
Exactly. But I think it's going to be interesting because, you know, Congress, at their year-end spending bills, they're like, wait, should we really let this go? Now, I'm told it's going to be going, but we've had that 5%, because remember, this was supposed to come out in 2020. And because of COVID and everything, I think actually 2019, they put it on hold and said, no, we're not doing it because we have to adjust the fee schedule because of COVID, all that stuff, and the pandemic. So they pulled it back for 3 years. And now they're saying, this is the new add-on. But remember, everybody, this has a budget neutrality issue. So they're pulling money from other services to allow this service to be added on. And CMS says that they believe that maybe the valuations for office visits doesn't adequately reflect the cost of caring for complexity of certain kinds of visits. And, but they didn't really give, they talked, I call it Medicare speak. They, you know, they call it resource costs with primary care and other longitudinal complex patients, but we have no definition of what they feel is complex. And Sean and I were talking about this offline. They're telling us what not to do before they're telling us what to do. So the first thing is they tell us, and this was actually in the final rule, they say not all E&M will be eligible. So they say, do not report this, or how they say this is it would not be appropriately reported if you're a physician or a professional who, whose relationship with the patient is of a discrete, which can be, to me is funny, discrete routine or time limited nature. So mole removal, they said simple virus, which again, is it the doctor's decision is simple virus or CMS's definition? Seasonal allergies, new onset of gastroesophageal reflux, treatment for fractures, they said no. So they said it's really when a billing practitioner has not taken the responsibility for ongoing medical care and consistency over time, then this is not something that you should be reporting. But here's where it gets really interesting, is that in on page 429 of the final rule, it says the relationship between the patient and the practitioner is the determining factor when using this add-on code. So how do you establish that relationship besides new and established patients? Does this patient have to be under chronic care management? Does this patient have to be seen for a long period of time? But if they're stable, let's say they have hypertension, but it's a long, you know, they're stable, they just get their, you know, refills. That's really not, I don't want to say and put the words in the mouth of a provider. I don't want to say it's not complex, but is it complex in the definition that this code captures? So they say it's not in the clinical condition itself, but rather they call it the cognitive load of continued responsibility of being a focal point for all needed services for this patient.
It's
confusing. I feel like cardiologists going, yay, and primary care going every single time the patient comes in.
I feel like Will Ferrell in that movie, Old School, where he blacked out and then he came to and he's like, wait, what just happened? And I'm not trying to make light of this because I think what's going to happen, and sometimes I wish that I was truly a prognosticator and, you know, you could call me Nostradamus. I think what's going to happen is 18 months from now, 24 months from now, we're going to be talking about this code again, but we're going to be talking about it for all the wrong reasons. We're going to be talking about all the clawbacks. We're going to be talking about how it was targeted by TPE. We're going to be talking about how it's on the OIG's work plan.
Yeah.
And we're probably going to have some providers who have been indicted civilly under the False Claims Act because the verbiage is so is so just convoluted.
Yeah.
That,
well, they came out and said that this is what Medicare said. They said, well, we expect this will be billed 38% of all E&M service initially, and then when it's fully adopted, about 54%.
Yeah, I saw
they're
that.
On something. That's low.
Yeah, I think it's going to be closer to 90%. But, you know, this is something that I said to you as well. You know, we already have prolonged evaluation and management services. Those are already difficult to use, right? Because there's thresholds and there's other things that come into play.
Well, and they're only to add on to level 5 or the highest value in the hospital. Right. And the problem is that because CMS and AMA got together and said, yeah, let's include, you know, non-face-to-face, the time can be manipulated so easily.
Right. But here's my question to you. If the prolonged E&M service add-on codes were rewritten to only apply to the highest level E&M, right? Level 5 in the office setting. Then how can you not limit this code on all other E&Ms like 2s, 3s, and 4s? I mean...
And it doesn't.
That's my point.
Well, and the other thing is that my question was on that, because we were able to ask questions on the CMS call, and you know it means you're being put into a black hole. But I was like, oh my gosh, they're answering my question. So I said, who decides which condition is serious and what's the criteria? And they said, well, we don't define descriptions that are serious, but we can give you some examples of when not to use it, which I already did. You know, the simple virus, the removal of a mole, allergies, things like that. But I also asked a second question why they had me on. And I said, what if two different providers and different specialties are billing this on the same date of service? CMS doesn't address that in the final rule or in their document. Well, so do you think both will be paid if the base codes are paid?
No, I think whoever gets their claim in first is who's going to get paid. And you're going to have to argue it via an appeal.
Somebody else asked, based on coming back to your question on the prolonged cares, they said, would you be able to sign the office visit, the add-on code, and the add-on code for prolonged care? And again, we looked through the CMS proposed rule and we looked in the final rule, and it doesn't say that you can or can't use it. It says maybe you can bill it the same, but it doesn't say you can't. And then it doesn't give us a list of what the, and I'm air quoting, the other specialties are that they say could be using it. But, you know, here's some quotes that they talk about as far as how to figure out which specialty. It says, specifically, we look into account the likelihood that primary care specialties will have higher utilization. So we know that primary care is there. They said surgical specialties will have the lowest utilization since they're less likely to establish longitudinal care relationship with patients. Well, what about those patients who have redo vascular surgeries
every three years?
And then they said other specialists are more likely to have longitudinal care relationships, since they kept saying surgical specialties, but less likely than primary care. And I'm like, what does that say? I mean, you've shared with us before, you're on certain heart medications. So to me, your cardiologist could use this code, you know, and it doesn't seem like they're defining some of that or specific documentation requirements. That's a big one I've been asked. People are like, what's the documentation requirements? Well, the final rule doesn't have that. And I just feel that CMS may be looking for claims data to see, you know, that longitudinal, I hate that word now. It's kind of like social distancing. I'm like, I hate that phrase now. It has longitudinal relationship with the patient. And I'm assuming they're going to have some diagnosis coding edits, but we just don't know what those are going to be. And I don't know, Sean, did you? So I sent you this morning, and you probably saw it already. Mm-hmm. The other document that Medicare just put out, and they put it out when did it come out? It came out, well, it released on the 21st of November, but actually we got it last week. And that was the one about this code now with the modifier 25. So you saw that, right?
Yes.
So it says that you can't use this code when you also have a claim on the same date, same claim. So you bill a 99204. Let's say you remove something or you did a procedure or something where required the E&M service to have a 25 modifier and you want to use this longitudinal add-on, you can't. They said this will not be paid when you use 25 modifier. So there's a limitation there. I actually had an office ask me, well, then can we just bill the minor procedure on a different date?
No.
I'll let you take that one. So if you do it on the 10th, can you bill it on the 11th just so you can get it all?
Yeah.
I know.
Listen, here's what I would suggest. And I'm saying this to, and again, this program is not meant to give legal guidance or legal advice. Okay. Get with your general counsel or get with your external counsel if you want legal advice. What I'm sharing,
compliance advice. Advice we can give.
Yeah, this is compliance guidance, right?
Right.
It's non-binding, doesn't have the effect of law, blah, 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 blah. Okay. I think the attorney should be happy with that. here's the guidance that I would give to our listeners if you were my client. Don't bill this code out of the gate. Sit back and wait. And a lot of folks are going to be like, yeah, but Sean, you know, it's vague. It's ambiguous. You know, so why can't we interpret it the way that we interpret it? Because that's not how a pay and chase system works, which is what Medicare is. You have local coverage articles, or you have guidance documents that have been published. Again, they're ambiguous. They're convoluted. But they're written that way on purpose because it gives the government an out. And it gives them an out in being able to interpret something the way that they see fit. It's like when a prosecutor charges somebody with a vague crime because they create a narrative to fit the crime. It's the same thing here. I personally would sit on this code. I would wait until the end of Q1 or mid Q2, see what kind of guidance is coming out with clarifications. Excuse me. See if any practices are dealing with clawbacks or offsets, and then go from there. Now, if you're one of those practices where you have providers who are like, heck no, I want the money, this is a chance to increase my bottom line, then I would be very careful. I would write a policy that mirrors the guidance that has been published, and I would use comment boxes, and I would use parens to put in your interpretations. I would not use loose interpretations. I would try to create something that is a longitudinal explanation. Hey, how did you see how I did that there, Terry?
I see how you did that. Well, and I'm going to take it a step further. Yeah, so I'll contrast a little bit of what you said. So I would say that if you're, let's say you're a primary care office, let's start there. You're probably the safest to use the code because that seems to be the focus.
Right.
So if you are somebody that, let's say you have a patient that you're monitoring on hypertension, they're on, and I'm just using that because that's a pretty prevalent chronic condition out there. And let's say the patient's on medication, but they're having a hard time being controlled. Even with medication, you've tried several different things. Their lifestyle is not conducive of, you know, controlled hypertension. And so the patient's constantly coming back in to be monitored. The physician's not only taking responsibility to try to control it, they've also sought help out from a specialist, but they are the ones, the primary care doctor is the one that's really the longitudinal, see, I did it too, the physician that's really monitoring this. And let's say the patient also has some other chronic conditions that are contributing to the problem. And maybe there's also some personal situation with the patient that spikes the hypertension. You see the complexity I'm showing here. I think that you need to get together as a group, as a practice, as a physician, and come up with not just diagnoses, but patient situations and patient encounters and understand when it's appropriate. And really, like Sean said, bide by what you have created policy-wise, because if it ever comes back to bite you that, well, that visit wasn't appropriate, or the fact that they started off with the negative. They start off, well, here's what not to do. Here's the diagnosis we wouldn't want to see. Here's the modifier we don't want to see with that. I think there's going to be more denials than payments. So I think that, yeah, you could be inflating your AR thinking you're going to get paid, then spinning your wheels with your staff saying, appeal, appeal, appeal. And the payer is, it seems like, the max. And I don't see any NCD yet. I think they're going to have a lot of leeway on when to pay this code, this add-on. And it's $15, people. It's not a lot of money.
That's what I was going to ask you. What is
it? Yeah, it's $15.69 is the average.
Okay.
So you know, there is a cost there, especially if you're a primary care physician that you do a lot of office visits. And the other thing, and I think Sean and I kind of touched on this, I think you need to have a policy on frequency. If you start billing this with every single encounter that patient comes in for, I see that being a problem, Sean.
No, I agree with you. And that's where I was leading to in creating a very specific policy and trying to, so that in the event this has to go before an administrative law judge on an appeal, that you could submit what CMS gave as ambiguous guidance and then how you created a policy using that vague guidance and added more specificity to it to try to make it usable, to make it, you know, something that made sense.
Right. So I've had a couple of specialists say, well, I get this because I'm definitely that. So here's a couple scenarios for specialists moving away from primary care. So I had a rheumatologist say, do you think this goes from, like, absolutely. I could see that because the pain management, you know, my sister-in-law, she's been seeing rheumatologists for 20 years, bless her soul. And she's just having a really tough time with just chronic pain, and they've tried everything. Now she's on a quarterly injection. And I mean, it's just sad to see the deterioration. And that truly, to me, every time she comes in, I could see that being there. But an oncologist asked me, what about me? And I said, well, here's the thing. You know, I do see that some patients may have a long-term, in your mind, stint with you because of radiation, chemo, whatever. But as soon as they're done with that, you transfer them back to the primary care. And if they're not under the oncology care anymore, as far as treatment, I don't know if you would qualify for that, because there's no guideline on what is considered long-term.
Yeah. I think I would argue that one, right?
Yeah. Because that's tough.
Because I mean, what is the typical duration, right?
It's 8 months. Long, 8 months, right? Is average with an oncologist.
So, you know, look, I think for the duration that an oncologist is engaged in long-term care of a patient's chronic problem, right? Because cancer is a chronic problem, and you are considered, you know, to be a cancer patient all the way through 5 years, you know, until you hit that remission stage, right? Where they say, you know, you're cured, or whatever term they use for it. I don't know. I think this is a very tricky code.
Right.
I think this is something that folks need to weigh the pros and cons before you just go to your doctor, or you just take something that your provider says to you as, hey, here's a revenue generator. Again, to Terry's point, nationally, it's $15.69. So in urban areas, in rural areas, it's going to be less than that.
Yeah.
Outside of metropolitan areas, you know, in other localities, it's probably going to be lower than that, you know, maybe in the $13 range, maybe in the $12 range. I just think this is one of these codes that I would sit on, and I would wait for more clarification, more guidance. And if you don't want to wait, then you need to be uber aggressive and create a very comprehensive policy
before 2024. We're in December now, so you need to have this ready to go. All the physicians in your practice, or if you're a solo practitioner, you need to have something in writing, because if somebody comes back to ask you, it means that, you know, you can say, here's how I read it, here's how I interpret it, here's what I believe this patient population, that, you know, they should have this. And, you know, I feel that this is why we did it. Yeah. You know, I think of cardiologists or pulmonologists with patients who have COPD. Or let's take it a step further. What have we been dealing with for the last 3.5 years?
COVID.
Now we have long COVID, and people are just not able to pull themselves out of the effects from COVID, or even the effects if the vaccine had a bad effect on you. And there's primary care doctors that are really dealing with a lot of stuff with that.
Yep.
And so I think I probably wouldn't sit on it if I was primary care and had a certain patient population, or if I was cardio or pulmonary rheumatologist. But to Sean's point, and I see where you are, because remember, Sean's involved in a lot of these legal cases. If you're going to use it, I 100% agree with him that you need to write it up. It's kind of like having a compliance manual. You need to have direction and some kind of policy on this code, because it's going to be out there as, you know, an issue, especially again, because they gave us now two published guidance, the final rule, you know, AMA also chimed in on this. And then that's MedLearn Matters article. And they're basically saying, here's what not to do. They haven't given us guidance on, well, here's what you should do. No, they're saying, here's what we don't want to see.
Right.
And, you know, so I would definitely have a policy.
And the last thing that I'll say on this topic is, if you are going to bill it, I would be auditing this code specifically on a monthly basis. I mean, if it's being utilized even 30% of the time, let alone 54% of the time, I would audit the fire out of this code to make sure that you have substantial documentation to support it. I would be looking for keywords like, you know, complexity of the care, exorbitant amount of time,
right?
You know, those key trigger words that would lead a Medicare auditor to the conclusion of, hey, this is a complex patient. This is a sick patient. But, you know, as they say, sometimes you can lead the horse to water. You just can't make it drink. So no matter how good your documentation is, it's still going to be considered subjective by other individuals, especially if they're non-clinical individuals, trying to figure out whether or not there's a complexity of care and whether or not you've provided longitudinal care, whatever the flip that means.
Right. Well, and I would say that if you're looking for a base of how to write up your policy on this, if you have any care management, not just regular care management patients, but the complex care management patient, that's probably a place to start. So if, you know, because I think they're going to be looking for that type of patient.
Yep. I agree. All right. Okay. Well, you know, I thought this was an excellent segment. It gave us both an opportunity to kind of chime in on our subject matter expertise in this area. And I think that's what folks enjoy. Next week, my friend, will most likely be our last episode for 2023. So we got to make it a good one.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right, and to each and every single one of you, thank you so much for tuning in, logging on, and hanging out with Terry Fletcher and I just for a little while each and every single week, except those weeks where we can't do it. Usually it's because of me, not Terry. So keep me in your thoughts and prayers this week. I will be in Boston. I have my final federal criminal trial of the year coming up Wednesday and Thursday this week, and I'm about as excited for that as one could imagine. So I'll leave it there, my good friend Terry. I hope you have a great rest of the week.
Thank you. You too.
All right. And to each and every single one of you who tunes in, logs on, and hangs out with us each and every single week, thank you all so much. We'll be back next week with our final Monday coding and compliance roundtable. And then Terry and I will be back Tuesday with our final hashtag Terry Tuesday on the compliance guy for 2023. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to the Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media at The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.